With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast, coming to you from the top floor of my Wall Street HQ here in Dublin, Ireland. I'm James and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor Emmett Savage and our head analyst Rory Caron. In this week's episode, we're talking about Tesla becoming a $100 billion company, Teladoc's new acquisition and what it means for the company, and why Warren Buffett is holding on to $128 billion in cash. So we were going to start off this episode talking about Tesla and Elon Musk, but Rory, before that, you've some very important Baby Yoda news to update us on.
Yeah, well, during the New Year's Eve special, we made predictions for the year.
Yeah.
And my actual prediction, which was that Beyond Meat would drop 50%, hasn't been going very well.
Yeah.
But my joke prediction that long Baby Yoda would be a brilliant investment thesis for 2020 is going great, because Build-A-Bear stock, which was dead in the water before this, I think, like, the company...
I didn't even know they were publicly listed.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at them ages ago. They're like a $40 million company. Like, they really, like, were small cap.
Yeah.
But their stock has gone up 62% since they announced that they are going to have a Baby Yoda doll last week. So, yeah.
That's a pretty solid investment thesis.
The opening ripples of what I think is going to be mania.
It's a long-term trend, buy Build-A-Bear.
No, definitely buy Baby Yoda. Anything Baby Yoda related, you can set up a little portfolio based on
Baby Yoda bubble. Yeah. Now, we had Bitcoin, we had weed, now it's Baby Yoda.
So rewind a bit. Is Baby Yoda only on The Mandalorian?
Yeah.
He's not in a movie?
No. Right. And we don't even know if he is Yoda. In fact, I think he's not.
Oh, I see.
He's just a Yoda looking character that's very small.
Jim Henson, R.I.P. It sounds like another Muppet. Is that approximately correct?
Yeah,
we're going to lose listeners over that comment.
To the ones still listening, on with the show.
So moving on to Tesla. Since the 1st of January, Tesla stock has been on an incredible run, up 30%. In the past year, the stock has almost doubled, and the company now, this week, has hit a market cap of over $100 billion. This makes it the most valuable US car company of all time and the second most valuable global automaker, just behind Toyota. So, Rory, what's driving this growth for Tesla? What's happened at the company that's pushing it up this much?
What's driving this growth? Well, look, there's actually quite a few different things going on in terms of, like, actually how the business is going. So, you know, Model 3 deliveries are up they had over 300,000 for the year, which was more than double what they had in the year before. Their total vehicle sales over the entire range is up 50%. They opened up a new factory in China, which went from breaking ground to actually producing vehicles in 12 months.
Wow.
Which is pretty impressive, and that factory's already hit 3,000 units per week, which is 150,000 cars a year, if you're doing the math. It's actually cash flow positive for the last 12 months as well, which is a big turnaround from the year before, where they were, you know, losing billions of dollars a quarter. So, I mean, they actually got an upgrade recently. I can't remember what investment bank gave them the upgrade, but the upgrade was based on good execution, which is not something you typically associate with Elon Musk and Tesla.
Yeah.
Like, they are typically the company that overpromises and underdelivers ad nauseum.
Yeah.
But they are firing at the moment on all cylinders, and are bigger than Ford and GM combined.
Can we talk a minute about the China factory? Because I think that's quite important. Obviously, you know, Tesla's perpetual problem has been production numbers, but in opening that factory in China, is there any advantages in terms of getting further into the Chinese market with having an actual factory in the country?
Of course, that's why they opened it. That was, like, part of the whole reason why. I mean, first of all, China is the factory of the world, as we know. But yeah, having that, you know, that factory opened in China, building the cars in China, has opened up a huge amount of opportunity for them. You know how the Chinese government are in terms of who they let operate in their space. increase. And this was obviously, you know, has helped them dramatically in terms of like tax breaks, in terms of like what they're allowed to do in the country. And yeah, it's going to be very positive for them, especially the speed that they got that factory up and running. And now they're trying to do the same trick again in Germany, which is causing a few little issues in terms of there's some environmental concerns over there. But what seems to be happening now with Tesla stock, or the reason it seems to have had such velocity, is there's definitely what we call a short squeeze going on.
So maybe explain that a little bit more. So obviously the idea of shorting a stock is kind of betting against a stock.
Yeah, it's betting against a stock, but the mechanics of it are a bit more complicated, and I'm not going to get too dragged into the weeds of it. But essentially what you're doing, you short a stock, is that you are borrowing a stock from another investor. Yeah. And you're selling it to take the cash. Now, this is all theoretical. Nothing's actually changing hands in this scenario. But let's say a stock is at $500. I borrow it off another investor, sell it to someone for $500, but I have to return that stock to the original investor at some point. So if the stock price goes down, I get to buy it at the cheaper price and give it back. If the stock price goes up, I have to buy it at the more expensive price and get it back. So that's kind of the mechanics of shorting a stock. Yeah. And what happens in a short squeeze is, let's say you have a heavily shorted company, and Tesla was certainly a heavily shorted company. If the stock price goes up, you know, let's say there's some good news, a good earnings report or something, and the stock price goes up a bit, short sellers tend to get nervous, they want to exit their position, but because of the mechanics, they have to actually buy the stock.
Okay.
So they're not selling anything, they're buying something, which actually drives the stock price even higher.
Yeah.
And then you have this kind of chain reaction where more short sellers get more nervous, and something like a 10% bump, or let's say news that would typically result in like a 10% bump could lead to a 20 or 30% bump because there's all this additional buying trying to cover short positions.
Yeah.
And there's actually, if anyone wants to check on my Twitter account, there's an interesting graph which is Tesla's stock price along with the percentage of the stock that was shorted, and they basically just divulge over the last 3 months where the amount of people shorting the stock has gone down rapidly while the amount of the stock price has gone up rapidly.
Yeah. So it's definitely an influence. If a company is heavily shorted, there's definitely a correlation between that and when there is some good news received, a bump in price.
Yeah, 100%. And there's, you know, very contrarian investors will typically look for companies that are heavily shorted.
Surely a very risky strategy.
Very risky, but, you know, it's... It's. I mean, if you think about it, it's probably less risky than shorting a stock because even though it's going to be much more volatile, when you short a stock, you theoretically are opening yourself up to limitless losses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So with the Tesla market cap crossing $100 billion, Elon Musk is in for a bit of a payday, is he?
Not just yet, but yeah, it's looking that way. This was part of, so there's 12 tranches of bonus options that he is going to receive based on performance. The first big one was crossing the $100 billion mark. Now he's not going to just get it. They're not writing a check tomorrow because he's crossed it. It has to stay there for a particular amount of time. I think it's 1 month. It has to be over $100 billion for at least a month.
Okay.
And then the 6 month average has to be over $100 billion as well. So he's not just getting it right now. But yeah, it's the first of what would be a very lucrative bonus package for him.
So positive news, it appears, for Tesla. But Emmett, you signed up, or you went on the waiting list for Tesla, and you weren't overly impressed.
No, We're always an edge case here in Ireland, and the products that are rolling off the conveyor belt in California take a long time to get over to this island. So I put a deposit on a Tesla 3 years ago, and still awaiting that product. And there's been quite a lot of to and fro, and I'm not going to diss Tesla here because apart from being a shareholder, it's not really the forum or the format. But I mean, there is one aspect of Tesla where I think it's miles ahead of the competition, and it's in something that I studied in college 25 years ago. I never actually saw a practical application of this tech until now, which is neural networks. And Tesla is now using data to build what I reckon will be the world's most sophisticated cutting-edge neural network. Now, a neural network, I'm going back 25 years, so I'm sure the definition of a neural network has absolutely improved. But basically what Tesla is doing is it's using AI, machine learning, to build a network that learns and continues to learn and improve its learning. So it's a system of sensors, data, communications, CPU, peripheral hardware and software all working together that's collectively processing information and eventually learns like a human being. And I think that Tesla is absolutely, truly distinguished from all those other car manufacturers that it's so readily compared to because of this information it's gathered. Because it's getting real world miles, you know, out there from people just driving around, whether auto drive is on or not. So basically, if you're driving your Tesla, it is learning. And as Elon Musk said in Fortune a few months ago, he said, when one vehicle learns something, they all learn it. So there's a very powerful effect there happening in Tesla that I think is really difficult to value at the moment, because you don't know the true value of a technology until it's on your lap, until you actually feel it. But I just had a look at the numbers, and Tesla, whether autopilot is engaged or not, has had 12 billion miles logged of driving in its neural network, and that Waymo is something around 15 million miles. So when you look at the absolute data that Tesla, the business, has gathered, and not necessarily unleashed into a product just yet, I think we're looking at something that justifies it being a $100 billion company. And, you know, I saw somebody tweet during the week, and I retweeted the comparison of Tesla's valuation to all the other car manufacturers, and it stands out. I mean, it's towering above all the other ones. It's kind of shocked to see Aston Martin was only valued at $1 billion, like at the other end of the scale. But I think truly where Tesla will start to rise and continue to rise, or I should say, far beyond the short squeezes up the world, is the fact that it has a neural network that I don't think any other business can really compare to.
Just on that, I remember there was a story out probably in the last 2 weeks about the cars potentially randomly accelerating. Did anyone see this?
I read something about that.
So there was a couple of reports of the cars randomly accelerating, or sudden acceleration was what was being claimed, and Tesla came out and said that this was a short attack and that they have no evidence to back this up. But as someone rightly pointed out on one of the automotive message boards, like, well, if that is a problem, they'll just update the software, which is, when you think about that, that's incredible.
Like, there's no mass recall.
Which was always one of the big risks with investing in automobile companies, was that they regularly did have these massive recalls, which cost millions of dollars and really ruined the reputation of the company. Whereas Tesla just sends out an update over the internet.
That's right. It is absolutely amazing.
So moving on to another stock in our shortlist, Teladoc last week announced that they had spent $600 million in acquiring a fellow leader in the virtual healthcare space, InTouch. The market has reacted favourably to this news, with Teladoc stock up some 20% since the news of the deal was announced. This deal is expected to close by the end of 2020, but Rory, who are InTouch and kind of what do they do and how do they exist kind of in the virtual healthcare space?
Yes, they're acquiring this company called InTouch Health. I think the full valuation or the full deal comes in at about $600 million, which is a cash and stock deal. I think it's $150 million in cash and the rest in stock, which is pricey because it's about 7x sales of that company. Although, I think it was Jason Moser pointed out on Twitter, it's like a lot of it's with, they're paying a lot of it with stock, which is at all-time highs at the moment, which is essentially very cheap currency for them. So what it does is it adds 14,000 doctors and about 450 hospitals to the Teladoc platform. And I think there was a bit of confusion about whether they were just another version of Teladoc.
Yeah.
There is similarities for sure. But what Teladoc were, or their prime kind of market that they were going after, was employers. So they were going to the big employers in America saying, like, look, if you offer this to your employees as an option in their healthcare plan, it'll cut down on your healthcare costs overall, and it'll help in terms of absenteeism. You know, people don't have to take a day off to go to the doctor. They could do it, you know, they could talk to a doctor on their lunch break, or they could talk to a doctor in the morning before they head to work. And so this was kind of their sales pitch, and it's been operating very well for them, which is why the stock's up, I think, like 200% since we added it at this point. InTouch were coming at it from a slightly different direction. What they were doing was targeting hospitals and doctor's offices themselves, saying, like, look, if you need to cut down on the wait times that you have in terms of, you know, patients that are coming in regularly, what you can do is we'll offer you the service where you can actually do it over the internet and they won't be coming in, clogging up your waiting room, and basically you become more efficient that way. So what this now is a strategic acquisition where Teladoc are now trying to kind of broaden the range of what they can offer to people.
And it's not Teladoc's first acquisition either. Do they have kind of a kind of aggressive acquisition strategy and kind of they're kind of trying to dominate the virtual healthcare market in general?
Yes, I mean, they did. They purchased a company called Best Doctors a couple of years ago, which it's been a criticism that's been laid at Teladoc a couple of times now that they're just buying growth. And that is something that we see with high growth companies, especially the smaller ones, that, you know, the organic growth starts slowing down. And in order to keep the narrative going, they start acquiring companies. You know, Mindbody a couple of years was accused of it when they bought Booker. Eventbrite's been accused of it when they bought Ticketfly, and that integration didn't really go very well. But Teladoc's growing perfectly well by itself. These acquisitions that they add on are, they really are kind of broadening the range of things that they can deal with.
But very complementary to their core business.
Yeah, I think they're very complementary. They're more kind of bolt-on acquisitions than trying to integrate them into the whole network itself. And, you know, like, as Teladoc pointed out, JP Morgan did some research on telemedicine, and something 40% of the hospitals they surveyed said they intended to increase their telemedicine budgets over the next 5 years. So this deal does expose them to what is a growing industry. It's a new industry for them in a sense, but still in the same ballpark. It's the market loves it. Usually the acquiring company gets a kind of smackdown when they make acquisitions because people are always worried about acquisitions. And we've said many times before, acquisitions typically destroy shareholder value. But so far the markets are acting well, and Teladoc is being on quite a run over the last couple of weeks.
Roy, do you remember several years ago we looked at iRobot before it divested elements of its business, and they had a robot that walked around meeting rooms helping out? It was an iPad on a broom.
Pretty much, on one of those, what are they called? The things you stand on?
Yeah.
Segway or... No.
The ones that were really popular with kids about two Christmases ago.
Oh, hoverboard.
Hoverboard. It was a hoverboard with a stick and an iPad attached.
I thought you were talking about a pogo stick. Here it comes. Well, I had a look at the products that Teladoc have bought basically through its acquisition, and did you know that in acquiring InTouch, Teladoc has now bought a whole range of robots? So they have at the low end, the low acuity stuff, you know, their iPads. But InTouch go all the way through to a range of robots a la iRobot back in the day. Now I'm sure they're significantly more sophisticated, if I recall the Oak that iRobot did correctly, but Vita is their kind of high-end robot that has a consultant surgeon at the other end. But they have quite an impressive array of complicated looking doctors on a stick. But it's interesting because Teladoc now has effectively, through this acquisition, gone into the hardware world. Now, I don't know how big a part of their world it will be forevermore, but you'll have a look on their website and see there's a whole bunch of mechanical friends now have joined.
Well, I think small parts.
It's quite clear, Emmett, you're not a marketer or a doctor on a stick.
Did you ever remember, I'm probably the only one who remembers a TV show called Buck Rogers in the 25th century?
No, but I know the
His
reference.
Best friend was Tweety. Some of them remind me of the little robot Tweety in Buck Rogers.
So before we move on, I just want to talk about some of the great stuff we have in the My Wall Street app at the moment. Already this year, we've added our brand new Stock of the Month report, a new stock addition to our market-beating shortlist, and over 10 new insights written by our analyst team here at My Wall Street. We've also launched a brand new feature exclusively for subscribers to My Wall Street this month, the Stock of the Month podcast. This is where you can listen as Rory and I delve deeper into the most recent Stock of the Month report and answer some community questions about why we picked this particular stock. January's episode is already live in the My Wall Street app at the moment, so make sure to log in and check it out. Emmett, next we're doing Company We Never Talk About. What company do you want to talk about this week?
This week we're going to talk about a company everybody knows, which is Starbucks.
Yeah.
One we never talk about. But rather than just, you know, kind of regurgitate a whole bunch of numbers about Starbucks, I thought we'd have a little quiz.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you five facts about Starbucks. And the two of you have to listen carefully and decide, is it true or false? Okay.
Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely.
So we're going to lowball. The first one's an easy one. In Starbucks, coffee masters wear blue aprons. True or false?
False.
True.
The correct answer is, in Starbucks, coffee masters wear black aprons. So 1-0 to Rory.
Yes.
Rory, did you know they wear black aprons?
I just knew they didn't wear blue aprons. I'd never seen anyone in a blue apron in Starbucks.
I'm not sure what it means. I mean, what do you need to do to become one of the owners of a black apron? Is it swim, like, you know, 50 lengths of a swimming pool full of coffee, or what do you reckon?
probably not that.
Probably not that. Okay, fact number two. Starbucks has its own movie studio.
True.
True.
I don't know, actually. I do know it has its own sound label called Hear Music. I don't think it has its own movie studio.
That's why I thought they might.
Yeah. They have their own record label called Hear Music.
They definitely got into some sort of like producing their own original content, like every other company correct. In the world. But
well, they actually have artists I've heard of, such as Paul McCartney, James Taylor and Joni Mitchell.
Really?
Yeah. But no Prima Malone or any of them, you know. So yeah, Starbucks has a record label called Hear Music. Okay, so despite me kicking this quiz off, I can't absolutely tell you how you scored on that one because I don't believe they have a movie studio.
Let's say we were wrong.
Yeah, we'll say, okay, so it's 1-0. So Starbucks, the name Starbucks derives from an Emily Bronte book called Wuthering Heights,
false.
One of the characters.
False.
Correct. It is actually the first mate in Herman Melville's book, Moby Dick, as I'm pretty sure you both knew anyway. So we're 2-1 to Rory. Fact number four, Starbucks only has three concepts for its stores. And don't worry, it's not a number question. Does it have concept stores, I guess, is the question.
And yeah, they had a rotisserie one at one point. So I'm going to say true.
Yeah, true.
Well, you're both right. But what's interesting is they actually have secret shops. For example, one called Roy Street Coffee and Tea in Seattle. And it sells things far beyond beer, such as wine, beer, gourmet cheeses that can't be mass produced. So they actually use a range of secret shops for testing out concepts and see how well they're going to go. And the final question in our quiz is, has Starbucks ever been sued for underfilling its cup?
Yeah, I'd say it definitely has been.
Yeah, it has to be true.
In 2006, two people from Northern California filed a class action lawsuit after suggesting that Starbucks has a system that means lattes are 25% smaller than menu claims.
I think I read that, or there was one definitely, and it was about the ice lattes or something, and some guy, he like took out the ice. Yeah. And then when the ice was out, it was below what they were advertising as.
Well, the lawsuit was dismissed, you'll be pleased to know. So I think on that round, Rory takes the golden coffee cup. So let's talk about Starbucks as a business for a moment. It is one of those stocks, I was thinking about it this morning, that I think you could safely just buy it and forget about it for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's an indestructible brand. It has a dividend yield, 1.8% at the moment. It's opening around 600 stores annually in China at the moment, where it saw 4% growth there last year. Like, it's a business that will just keep going.
Yeah.
It's in the same category, as we all know, as Disney and Diageo. And it offers a product that people won't, grow sick of. It's not that it's sugar-based. It's not that the world is going to come out with some coffee facts that we don't like. So, yeah, I think Starbucks is a wonderful, very long-term investment. It's one of those things that can just sit at the bedrock.
And as you said, it's such a kind of well-known brand that it's often quite, around here, we kind of forget about it sometimes.
Yeah.
And we forget it's there. And it's up 70% since we picked it, which isn't incredible growth, but it's still pretty impressive.
Well, this is it. It's safe, solid growth. And their CEO, Kevin Johnson, is a tech guy. He's the former CEO of Juniper Networks. He worked at Microsoft. And he, you know, he's bringing that view that we walk into McDonald's, you'll see that mostly now you have to order through giant touchscreens. And the modernization, the tech drive behind businesses is there. And to have a CEO who like is building the future of the business around technology, investing in its app rewards program, mobile order and pickup and delivery, that technology is the driving force behind so many businesses. You would think that a traditional business like Starbucks, which takes coffee beans in the back door and hands them out the front door in the form of a hot drink, isn't all that tech, but it's absolutely tech-enabled business. So I think they have a good CEO. I think they have a great product, an indestructible brand, pays a dividend, it's growing. And while we never talk about it, it's very often there's not a whole lot to say about some of our companies. They're just wonderful long-term bedrock businesses, and I think Starbucks is one of them.
Isn't there a great story about the founder Howard Schultz and why Starbucks don't serve hot sandwiches? It was something like he went into a store once and there was a really bad smell of burning cheese or something.
Oh, I've heard that as well, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember details, and it was that it was kind of overcoming the smell of coffee, and he just, well, probably not straight away, but that's why they don't serve hot kind of sandwiches and stuff anymore, because it should be the smell of coffee.
I was quite surprised with that when they brought in your man as the CEO. I know he'd been there for quite a while, but I would have bet big money that they were going to take Mary Dillon.
Mary Dillon, yeah, exactly. We had that debate.
The Ulta CEO, because she'd been put on the board just about a year ago, but maybe in the future.
And loyalty and rewards programs are
her bread and butter. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Did we have a debate here in the podcast about Mary Dillon becoming the next CEO? If not, it was downstairs anyway. Yeah. We had a chat about it. Coffee, according to Wikipedia, Kaldi, the 9th century Ethiopian goat herd, discovered coffee when he noticed how excited his goats became after eating the beans from a coffee plant. Now, that's a proven product.
Now, what other podcast would you hear that on?
So hats off. This issue is dedicated to Kaldi, the 9th century Ethiopian goat herd.
So that is Starbucks, the company we never talk about. Moving on to Jargon Busters. And the first question we have this week is from Stefan through the My Wall Street app. And he asked, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is reportedly holding some $128 billion in cash at the minute. When is it appropriate for an individual investor to hold cash? Emmett, I'll throw that over to you.
The thing, comparing, I suppose, looking at Warren Buffett, hoarding cash, as it's called, which I don't think is a very appropriate definition.
He famously said cash is a bad investment.
Yes, it is a bad investment. And the problem that Warren Buffett and Berkshire has is deploying vast billions of dollars is not an easy job. I know it's a quality problem, but it's not an easy job. When you bring it down to us mere mortals, I think different laws of investing apply, and in fact, calling it a law is too rigid. I think I have personally never been more than 5% in cash. And what I mean by that is in 25 years at least, my portfolio has never had more than 5% cash in it. And that's not me proclaiming that that is the right strategy, but you're either investing or you're not. And I think most people will have the cash partition in their mind and something else, a bank account. And that's what they use to keep their life on the road and pay their bills and their rent and buy their lunch. And then in your stock investing portfolio, we're in it to invest for the long term and never sell. So I understand the question is coming from the fact that we're at the tail end of a 10 plus year bull market.
And
that is a logical question. And I've asked myself that question a lot. I don't personally have the insight to say one should go into cash now, but I am of the mind that if you're investing, you invest, you find great businesses now, and you hopefully have the resources to find more cash if they go on sale.
Yeah,
because I don't have the precise number at the moment, but if you miss the top 10 days in a decade of investing, your returns are going to be significantly reduced.
Yeah.
We can get that fact another time, but it's incredible that in a 10-year period, if you're out of stocks on the 10 best days, your CAGR will actually be significantly eroded.
Yeah.
So looking at Warren Buffett, cash is a bad investment because inflation decreases its spending power. I do believe people should have some cash on the sideline, but it's quite a personal decision.
And yeah,
there's no absolute magic formula. What do you think, Rory?
I think first of all, for the last 5 years that we've been doing this, people have been saying, sure, there's a recession coming.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like...
Yeah, that's 5 years you would have missed out on if you'd...
Exactly. So like, even now when you look at like, oh yeah, it's been the greatest bull run of all time and we're a 10-year, you know, without a single recession. That's not how markets work. They don't operate. Yeah, they don't follow a schedule.
Yeah.
So yeah, it might feel like it's right about to hit, you know, bottom out or hit the ground, but like it sitting on the sidelines is you're going to lose more money or you're going to lose much more opportunity by sitting on the sidelines waiting for this day to happen. If you you believe 5 years ago there was going to be a recession, look at the amount of money left on the table. Like Warren Buffett just has always had this problem. He's like, for you know, when I was reading his autobiography, he used to have, or not his autobiography, sorry, it was who wrote the really good one?
Snowball.
I can't remember his name. No, not Snowball. The other one.
Making of American Capitalist. Yeah. Roger Lowenstein.
You know, back in the 1980s, they were having trouble deploying cash because they had so much of it that they'd have to find huge companies to invest in. They couldn't invest small amounts in small companies because it wouldn't have any impact on their on their bottom line. So they've always had that problem. I reckon he's hoarding cash because he's got a big acquisition target in mind.
So moving on then, another question we got in is from Killian, and he asked, why is Pinterest not in your showroom? Rory, I know you've been looking at Pinterest recently, so I'll throw this over to you.
Yeah, I really like Pinterest. Pinterest is a very interesting company. You know, they're a niche product, not necessarily niche in terms of a small market opportunity. They've got a huge audience, but it's very kind of specialized, and yet people love it. And their target demographic is the one that everyone is after. That 70% of the users are female, 34% of them are in that 18 to 29 year old age bracket, which is really powerful for advertisers. That is who they want to be targeting. And, you know, they're growing. They're still growing really fast. You know, they had 37% increase in international monthly active users in the last year, up to 235 million people. And I saw somewhere, I couldn't get this fact verified, but 42% of US adult women use Pinterest.
Wow.
Which is just insane numbers. Like, and also, there's something I really like about Pinterest, and this kind of, I'll take on a kind of side story here, but there's a book I read maybe 2 years ago called The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg, and he talks about, there's a whole chapter dedicated to Target, the big retailer, and how about 15, 20 years ago, they became absolutely obsessed with customer data. It became their number one strategy for building the business, and they went out and hired some of the best data scientists they could right out of college, promised them huge amounts of money and said, look, if you want to study data, we are going to find so much data on the American consumer, you won't know what to do it yourself. And the reason they wanted to do this was because they figured out that they had these coupons that they were sending out, and they wanted to be able to target each individual customer with the coupons that were going to align with what they were going to buy. And they became really, really good at it. The one thing they really wanted, or the kind of holy grail for the data scientists working for Target, was to find out when people were pregnant. And the reason, really, this was like, they had whole teams dedicated to trying to figure out this puzzle. How do you find out when one of your customers is pregnant? And they got so good at it that they were figuring out that their customers were pregnant like a week after they found out.
Wow.
That's how the subtle changes in how people were shopping alerted them to that. And the reason they wanted to know that information was because they knew psychologically people tend to spend a huge amount of money when they're going through big life changes. If they're moving house or getting married or having a kid or changing job, that's when you start spending big amounts of money on things, and that's when habits start forming.
Yeah.
So if they could find out when people are pregnant, they could send out coupons for the things that they were going to need for pregnancy, and that would get them into Target, and that would start a lifetime habit of coming to Target for those specific things. This was the book's really delves into much deeper detail into this, but they were so good at it that one day this father came in and started shouting at a store manager because he was like, "What are you doing sending my young daughter coupons for pregnancy stuff to do with pregnancy?" And he ended up calling the store manager back the next day to apologize, having had a conversation with his young daughter and found out that yes, she was indeed pregnant.
Wow.
So the reason I went off on that little tangent there is because Pinterest, the way it's set up, it's there for people when they're doing major life changes. It's people use it for planning their wedding, redecorating their house, moving to another, like, this is where they use Pinterest for. It's a kind of a scrapbook of ideas, a mood board, if you will. So I do like Pinterest quite a lot. The one problem I have with Pinterest is they haven't proven in any way the ability to monetize their international users. And that's not normally a massive concern. We know that international users are typically not as valuable as US users, especially from an advertiser's point of view. But the discrepancy between Pinterest is just really, really big. And I use the example of their ARPU, which is their average revenue per user. In Pinterest's case, this difference is just so stark that it's like they don't even have an international business at all yet.
Yeah.
So example, last quarter, they made $2.93 per US user. For international users, which is a much larger amount of people, it was 13 cents.
Wow.
Now, that's more than double what it was for the international users from the same period last year, but it's still way too low. It's like,
massive,
you know,
discrepancy.
They haven't proven that they can have any international business yet whatsoever. Yeah. If they do, or if we see signs that they do, it would definitely be a stock I'd like to add.
Yeah, very interesting.
So, to the three of us then, because I read their IR deck, their investor relation deck as well, Rory, and my read on it was there was no identifiable trend, positive trend in their key metrics they called out. And I spoke to a couple of friends who use Pinterest. And what I got was that there's now new competing websites for niche needs. So, for example, for the home, there's House. And House is the mood board for the house. So I landed on the same question we were asked, which is, why don't we have Pinterest?
Yeah.
You know, in My Wall Street. Yeah. And Rory and I said about our research. And so here's the question. Would you buy shares in Pinterest?
Well, like, as I just said, not yet.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm interested in the business. I think it's they're doing something different. They're doing something that, you know, isn't Mark Zuckerberg is not going to be able to just come in and totally replicate their business.
Yeah.
They've got a really loyal base
of
users and people seem to love the product. So I like it as a business. I just think if they could show some traction in international, if they get that ad business up and running, I'd be quite happy to invest.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I was quite dismissive of them, I think, when I first I'd always known of Pinterest, and when they first went to market, I was a bit dismissive. But, you know, as Rory said, when you see that engagement they have with that niche demographic, I think it's pretty incredible. If you saw some international growth, you'd be jumping on that.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, that's about it for today's Stock Club. We don't have time for the elevator pitch this week, but tune in 2 weeks' time, where Emmett and Rory pitch a stock that they think has the potential to become a 10-bagger or grow tenfold in value. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in the My Wall Street app at the moment. And if there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode of Stock Club, make sure to get in touch. You can catch us on Twitter, that's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club too. And if you're enjoying it, please leave a review for us on whatever podcasting platform you listen to us on. That's it from us. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.